Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Rigs Podcast. I'm your host, Sonam Yangdin. Israel today remains one of the most dynamic and vibrant entrepreneurial economies in the world, with more than 6,000 active startups, making it the world leader for startups per capita. The entrepreneurial and innovative spirits of Israelis are nothing short of inspirational and exemplary, and could offer a lot of insights and experiences to the fledgling startup culture in Bhutan and elsewhere. Bhutan has recognized the importance of entrepreneurship in the 1990s and also launched various initiatives towards reaping its benefits. However, it is still in its nascent stage today and calls for a vibrant and dynamic entrepreneurial development in the country. One of the authors of the Startup Nation, Saul Singer, writes, "Israeli culture and regulations reflect a unique attitude to failure, one that has managed to repeatedly bring failed entrepreneurs back into the system to constructively use their experience rather than leave them permanently stigmatized and marginalized. This perhaps speaks volume behind the success of Israel as a startup nation, having churned out thousands of high-growth entrepreneurs that revolutionized the global industries." To discuss more on this, we have Mr. Saul Singer with us today. Mr. Singer, welcome to the Rigs Podcast. We are honored and extremely elated to have you with us. And like I said, I'm a huge fan of your book. Thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure. I'm very happy to be with you on the podcast.
Mr. Saul Singer is the co-author of the best-selling book, Startup Nation, and former editor at the Jerusalem Post. He immigrated to Israel in 1994 and currently resides in Jerusalem with his family. So the one thing that everyone wants me to ask, and there's a lot of questions around, what are some of the attributes of the Israelis that have contributed to the massive success of the country as a startup nation? And also, as pointed in my introduction, how have the culture and regulations in Israel helped the innovation and startup ecosystem to flourish as seen today?
So that's the question we tried to answer in the book, is how did Israel become a startup nation, and what is it about Israel? And we talked about many different factors in the book. One of them is that Israel itself is a startup. And what I mean by that is that startups begin with an idea. And it's usually an idea that most people think is not a good idea, is crazy. Typically, that's what happens when entrepreneurs start with their idea. And then it takes a lot of drive and determination and willingness to take risk to turn that idea into a reality. I think a lot of early entrepreneurs make the mistake of thinking that their idea is the most important thing. Well, it's actually all the work to make it happen. There are a lot of ideas out there, but all the hard work and willingness to take risk to make it happen, that's what really makes entrepreneurship and makes great companies. And Israel itself began with an idea that most people thought was crazy. And it took a lot of drive and determination and willingness to take risks to make the idea of recreating a Jewish state after 2,000 years in a land that wasn't so friendly. That took a lot of audacity and a lot of work, and we're still working at it. So when you grow up in a culture where you learn that you need to work hard to make something exist, you can't take it for granted. I think that's part of what makes our culture more entrepreneurial. The other things, the military service, has been very important for us. But it's not something we recommend for anyone else, as we have a very unusual kind of service here. And the third big factor that we talk about in the book is that immigrants are natural entrepreneurs. We see this all over the world, that, say, you know, Indians in Silicon Valley, or, you know, Chinese outside of China, or many different examples of immigrant communities that are very successful as entrepreneurs. And that's because immigrants have those two characteristics. They were willing to take a risk, and they were driven enough to take that risk and start their lives over. And we're a country of immigrants. Everyone here came here, either themselves or their parents or their grandparents. Covers most of the country. So it's a country of immigrants. And that's another big part of our culture.
In a nutshell, it requires a lot of determination and drive and a lot of audacity to make an idea work. And you have also talked about the military service in Israel, which I find it very interesting to know that the Israelis are required to undergo a minimum of 2 or 3 years of mandatory military service. And I'm also excited to share about our national service called the Gelsung National Service, which will be rolled out in a few years' time. So I'm curious as to know, in what ways has the mandatory military service contributed to Israel's success, in your opinion?
Well, I think in many ways, the first thing that happens with young people who enter the military is they realize that it's not about them, that there are bigger things than them that are in some ways more important than them, like their unit, their community, their family, their country, and that they have to contribute to that and maybe even sacrifice for that. And that the way to do that is you have to work as a unit. Individuals can't accomplish much in the military, maybe everywhere, that we have to learn to work together and support each other. And that's something you learn very quickly in the military. And maybe the most important thing is that the essential part of the training in the Israeli military is they keep throwing challenges at you. Many of them, the kind of things that you think you'd have no idea that you were capable of doing. And you have this experience of doing things that seem impossible time and again. And your idea of what you can do changes radically. You feel that you're able to do bigger and bigger things, and you're not afraid of challenges. You're not afraid of taking responsibility. Many Israelis have the experience, for example, of commanding other people. They may not be officers; they may be sergeants. They have a few people under them. But imagine you're 18 or 19 years old, and you're in charge of other people and accomplishing a mission. Another thing that happens is that there are a number of big intelligence units here that are very steeped in technology. And Israelis learn a lot of cutting-edge technology in these units. But people, I think, make the mistake of thinking that Israeli success is based just on these units. And that's not the case. The minority of people go through them. And I think actually a more important aspect is the leadership aspect, leadership and teamwork and not being afraid of challenges. And it actually, when these young people get out of the military, they look for the kind of level of meaning and challenge that they had inside the military. They want to do important things. So that's another, I think, boost for entrepreneurship, because they have this taste for doing difficult things and this belief in themselves.
Thank you so much. In all of this, I'm also curious to know how the education system in Israel plays a critical role in producing successful entrepreneurs. So how is it different from the rest of the world?
So typically Israelis go into the military right after graduating from high school. So they don't go to university before that. They would go to university if they do after the army. I'm not sure how much Israeli education through high school before the army has such an influence. And I mean, I think that it's different than in many wealthy countries where young people spend their lives trying to get into the best university they can, working very, very hard to boost their academic skills. And in Israel, while many people go to the university later, the thing that's on their mind is to get into the best unit that they can, the best military unit. And for that, there's not that much you can do while you're studying in high school to prepare for that. You just have to wait and see what you're chosen for, and you have to work very hard when you're in the military. But I think it's a good thing that Israelis aren't losing their childhoods, because they are spending such an intense and competitive effort to get into the best school, because the best schools select for a very narrow aspect of talent. It's academic talent, maybe intelligence, but military units are looking for people who can work with others, who have traits that are good for leadership. And these are different things than universities look for. And I think it's actually a healthier kind of selection process. Now, after the army, I think when they do go to university, I think they get more out of it because they're more mature. They have a better idea of what they want in their lives. Often they take a break between the military and university. They're not in a hurry. They go work, they go travel. And so because they don't go automatically to university like people in many other countries, they're more intentional about it and they get more out of it. So that's, to me, the relationship between education and the military and entrepreneurship.
Thank you, Mr. Singer, for shedding light on that. From what we know, Israel is also one of the top countries in the world to spend the most money on R&D, research and development. How has that helped create the right conditions for a thriving startup nation?
So, yes, Israel spends about 4.5% of its GDP on R&D, which is the highest in the world. Together, we're usually about tied with Korea, also spends about 4.5%. But there's a big difference in that most of the R&D spending in Korea, I think, is government driven. In Israel, it's only about 1% of the 4.5% is government R&D. Most of it is the startups and larger companies. And so, in a way, the numbers of startups that we have allow us to spend so much on R&D rather than the reverse. They're the result of the startups rather than the cause. And I think actually, I mean, R&D spending by governments, putting money into science and that kind of stuff is good, but it doesn't necessarily produce startups and entrepreneurship. It's something that needs to be kind of considered in its own right. And also, I think people make a mistake when they think that technology and entrepreneurship are the same thing. That all of startups is technological. Actually, when you look at it, most startup companies, they may be based on technology, but the founders didn't invent a new technology. Like Mark Zuckerberg did not invent a new technology in order to develop Facebook. And then many, many other examples. They were using existing technology, but their innovation wasn't essentially technological. I think it's very important to remember.
So would your advice for Bhutan be the same? I mean, when it comes to investing in R&D?
Like I said, I think it can be good in its own right to invest in R&D, but it won't necessarily increase the number of startups. But I think another important thing to say here is that there are two kinds of innovation in a country. One is the innovativeness of the startups and the companies that are started. Another is the adoption of innovation from the rest of the world in your country. And these things, there's not a bright line between them, because a lot of the entrepreneurship is essentially adopting ideas that were started elsewhere and adapting them to your own country. That's tons of startups. That's what they do. They don't actually invent a new business model, but they adapt it to their country. And that takes a lot of innovation. It's not, you shouldn't dismiss it as copying, but it's essentially importing innovations from elsewhere. And when we think about what governments can do, I think there's, let's say, three big things that governments can do to help promote innovation. One is to not over-regulate, to not impose difficulties on the entrepreneurs. The kind of regulations that work for big businesses are often too heavy for very small businesses and certainly for startups. So in many countries, one of the first things to do is for the government to talk to the entrepreneurs and ask them, what are we doing that's making your life difficult? And try to stop doing those things. And that's easy because it costs no money, but it's actually hard because it takes a lot of political will. That's one thing. Another thing is to, actually there's more, but another thing for the government is to be a customer of the startups, is to try to use innovations that they're producing. And also, you know, people talk about data, how important data is, that data is the new oil and so on. And governments have data. And they, if they decide, they can collect even more data. And making that data available in a useful way to entrepreneurs is also very helpful. Another way that governments can help is they can work to connect the local entrepreneurs with entrepreneurs in other countries. This is often overlooked, and it's a critical thing. There's a organization called Startup Genome that ranks countries around the world in terms of their startup ecosystem. And they look at four different factors. And one of the factors is, how connected is your ecosystem to other countries? The ones that are more connected are going to grow faster. And they're right. They're right. If you think of two countries, A and B, and A tries to do everything itself, and B works hard to be a hub, both regionally and to connect with big ecosystems like, say, Silicon Valley or Israel, the more connected ecosystem is going to grow faster. And this doesn't happen naturally often. Governments can help with that process. And it's in a way very simple. It's getting the people from each country to meet each other, getting people from Bhutan to see, to visit and meet with entrepreneurs in other countries, and getting other, getting people from other countries to come to Bhutan and get excited about working with Bhutan. Because the reason countries don't work together is they just don't know how. They don't know who to call. Like if you're an entrepreneur in Bhutan and you want to work with Israel, how do you begin? You don't know anybody in Israel. But once you've visited and you met some great people here, then maybe you can start working with Israel and vice versa. I mean, Israelis wouldn't think of working with Bhutan, but if they went there, they would get excited. They would meet amazing people. They would see amazing problems, which, by the way, problems are very important to entrepreneurs. One thing that makes entrepreneurs is they get excited about problems, because they're always looking for something to solve. That's what a startup is. It's solving a problem. So Israelis in particular, they get excited by seeing big problems that they hadn't thought about. So that's another way that government can help. And the last way, and the in some ways, the way that has the most impact on the country and even on the startup ecosystem, is to realize that innovation is available from everywhere. You don't have to invent everything yourself. There's so much that a country can take, can implement. For example, e-government. I know the Bhutanese government is trying to move towards more e-government. That's excellent. There are many other countries that have done a great job, better than Israel. I think the UK and Korea have done, you know, great job at e-government. We're trying to catch up. Estonia has done a great job. Is, you know, look at what they've done and implement those practices. But it goes beyond. It's not just the making the government itself work, you know, in a more digital way. It's health, it's education, it's transportation, it's the cities, you know, it's every realm of business and life is changing very rapidly. And the countries that have the education of the future, or the transportation of the future, or the health of the future first, are going to be considered the most innovative countries. And there's a great saying, which is that the future is here, it's just not equally distributed. In other words, it comes to some places before others. And governments can have a big role in making their country one of the first to enjoy the innovations that are available. You know, digital health is a great example. I could talk about more, but this countries are essentially in an adoption race more than an innovation race. The adoption of innovation is the biggest part of the race, rather than trying to develop all the innovations yourself.
Thank you very much, Mr. Singer, for the wonderful advice. You said don't regulate, don't over-regulate. And government can be a customer of the innovation, making data available, connecting local entrepreneurs with the foreign entrepreneurs. They're basically being a bridge between the two entrepreneurs. And fifth one is implementing the best practices on going digital. Did I get that right?
Yes. I mean, basically being aware of the possibility of major shifts, like not just something a little bit better, but a completely different, like the horse and the car. The car wasn't just a faster horse. You know, a lot of places are working on making the horse go faster, But the places that had the car first, they were in a different category. It's like that with health, for example, where the current, the horse of health is waiting until people get sick and then trying to treat them. And the car is detecting problems early and preventing disease and really trying to move away from just treatment and catching things much earlier. And a lot of that has to do with data, with taking with various, you know, new tests that are not expensive, but widely available that can detect things early. Moving health to communities is another something that's, you know, very, of course, there's remote health has been, since the pandemic, has increased dramatically, is doing consultations over video. You know, it's endless, the possibility. These are things that don't necessarily cost much money, but they require a change in mindset. They require organization and effort, and they require, you know, awareness that it's possible and the desire to move it forward. I mean, these are things that don't exist in many countries, but countries that have them will be able to move to a new paradigm that's much more effective and actually much less expensive than our current way of doing health.
Thank you, Mr. Singer, for the advice on creating an enabling environment to produce successful and thriving entrepreneurs and startups. So your book, Startup Nation, offers several accounts of how and why the entrepreneurs in Israel are mostly successful, not only at home, but in the global arena as well. So could you please share a few of the inspiring stories of entrepreneurial feats that you find most fascinating?
So there are so many. One thing about Israel is that there are dozens or even hundreds of startups in just about every sector you can think of. You know, whether it's health or food or agriculture or cyber or transportation or, you know, just any sort of tech sector, there are Israeli startups. And I get excited about so many of them. A lot of them are in digital health, I think, are doing amazing things. Like there's a company called Tidal Care that creates a kit that allows people, parents or you know, community health workers to do a lot of tests that people would have to normally do in a doctor's office, you know, check for infections and heart and all the basic tests that when you go into a doctor, they do in your office, mostly can be done at home with one of these kits. Many, you know, another one, a number of companies are working on interpreting x-rays so that you can detect things, many more things, and detect them much better than a person looking at an x-ray. An algorithm can look at an x-ray and do the same thing, but more accurately and see more in it. But another area I'm excited about is food tech. One of the biggest problems in the world is food sustainability, access to food quality, and, you know, the resources, particularly that meat, raising cows and sheep and all these things take tremendous amount of water. They produce tremendous amounts of greenhouse gases. They take tremendous amounts of land. And now there are a bunch of new startups here in Israel that are creating substitutes that taste exactly like meat, but they're made of plants, or they're actually cells grown from the cow. Without the cow, you grow meat, in or you grow milk. There's a company called Remilk that's taken yeast and genetically engineered it to grow milk protein. So the same way you make beer or yogurt, you can produce milk. Another one called Redefined Meat. I've eaten hamburgers and things like that made of this meat here in Israel in restaurants, and it's amazing. You know, this could have a tremendous impact. And it also could make it. Right now, the problem is it's more expensive than regular meat. But once the price goes down below regular meat, it's a tremendous impact on the world in terms of accessibility of food and better nutrition in every country.
Wow, the times we really live in. Thank you so much. So this is my final question. What would be your advice to our young and budding entrepreneurs in the country?
So I think that one thing is to try to at first learn by working in, you know, existing startups. Another is not to be too protective of, or again, thinking that your idea is the essence. Because, you know, one thing about startups is that very few of them end up with the idea that they started with. Most of them, they start with one idea and they try to create a product and they test it. And it turns out that the thing that they thought was a problem wasn't an interesting problem, or their solution isn't the right solution. And the only way to figure that out is to start and to start working with people. You know, there's a whole methodology for this that's well known that can be learned for basically what it's called as product market fit. So the market is the product, is the problem. The product is the solution. And once what startups do is they search for that fit. And once they find the fit, then they're off to the races, and then they have to grow, which is another challenge. And there's so many resources now available. You know, again, with Mark Zuckerberg, when he started Facebook, his big challenge was to collect lots of servers, you know, that Facebook would sit on these, you know. Now you can buy, you know, as much space as you want from Amazon or Google cloud services. And it keeps going. There's many examples of things that were very difficult a short time ago that are very widely available now. Even artificial intelligence, you can essentially get it from companies that are producing it somewhere else and just start from there. So the tools are available. I think initial funding, that's something that governments can help with, but not too much. It's very important that they come from the private sector. And I think as countries are starting out, individuals in the country called angel investors, people who have been successful in one business or another, are often the best early investors in these companies. And also another very important thing is, don't think that you can do everything yourself. Make a team of people, of co-founders, who complement each other, not people who are the same. You want a group of people who complete each other, who are good at different things. You want to combine the strengths of different people. That's critical. You have to know what you don't know and not try to do everything yourself. And again, combine your strength with people from other countries. That's also great, because different people from different countries have different cultures and different strengths. And combining strengths is critical, I think, for success.
Thank you, Mr. Singer. Thank you for the wonderful advice. With this, we come to the end of the program. Thank you very much for your time and for really drawing the curtain behind the success of the Startup Nation. We look forward to having you in Bhutan someday. And at the same time, I would also like to encourage all our listeners to please grab a copy of the book and enjoy every bit of its content. Thank you.
Thank you for having me, Sonam. It's been very good, very good questions. And I hope that this time has been useful for your listeners.
Oh, very much. I'm sure our young entrepreneurs will be really inspired by what you talked about. Thank you so much.